Larry, I can't hear you.
We can't hear you.
I think he got kicked off, guys.
Is there any backup for Larry?
Is the moderator here?
The speaker is here. I'm Elizabeth D. I'm a compulsive overeater, recovered, living in Massachusetts. Oh, there he is. Good.
I'm here. So sorry, guys. Hey, there you go, Elizabeth. So let me start from this point. I want to welcome everyone to a special edition of Vision for You. My name is Larry Kay from Chicago, and I'll be the host for the presentation today. Today is Sunday, April 12, 2026. The share ID numbers for Friday, I'll give those to you, April 10th, the 7 a.m. meeting, that number is 23,355. That's 23355. And for the 10 a.m. meeting, that number is 23,356. That's 23356. This morning, A Vision for You presents Turning Points, A Walk Through the Big Book. Now, you know, given the fact that we have a disease that will, you know, ultimately kill us if it goes untreated, it stands to reason that we must get to the remedy quickly, right? And one of the problems is how one perceives this disease, because the disease may first appear like an adorable, fluffy little bunny rabbit, you know? It seems to be harmless, and there's no real danger. And you know, what's it going to do? Is it going to stomp us to death? Well, yeah, actually, all the salty, savory, crunchy things appeared to be harmless too to me. And the sugary dessert items, those appeared to be harmless. And, you know, there's a metaphor about perception that lends itself to illustrating this idea of implementing these 12 steps quickly. And then, of course, we do it for a lifetime. And that metaphor is about the weight of a cup filled with water. So we start with, you know, looking at how heavy is this cup of water I'm holding? And from my perspective, the absolute weight of the cup isn't particularly relevant. It really all depends on how long I hold the cup, you know. If I hold it for a minute or two, it's fairly light. It's not a problem. If I hold that cup for an hour straight, you know, then I got problems. My arms begin to hurt. And you try holding that cup for an entire day, now my arm's going to cramp up and the pain becomes excruciating. And eventually I'm going to drop that cup to the floor. It's just going to shatter. And the thing is, the absolute weight of the cup doesn't change, but the longer I hold it, the heavier it feels to me. Well, I would suggest to you that this is how it is with the steps. We take sometimes too long to get to the steps. We hold that cup too long. And we through our perfectionism and over analysis, we search for the why and everything, and we fizzle out, and the cup appears to be too heavy. But what if there was a way to change? What if there was a way to trust in this process, to do it quickly? The text that we study, the roadmap towards freedom, is miraculous indeed. It is. And with our Creator's help, we uncover, discover, and we discard that which has been blocking us from the sunlight of the Spirit. The awakening becomes organic. Now, joining us this morning to share her journey in navigating through the 12 steps and undergoing a spiritual transformation is Elizabeth D. from Massachusetts. And she is committed to the 12 steps and the 12 traditions as a way of life. And so it's with great appreciation that we invite her to the line this morning. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for that introduction, which was wonderful and quite moving to me. I'm Elizabeth Gillette, D. I'm Elizabeth D., a recovered compulsive overeater living in Massachusetts. I was 68 years old last Friday on April 10th. And that day is also the third anniversary of my abstinence. So I'm incredibly grateful that the stars aligned and I was asked to do this special edition today, because as I enter my fourth year of abstinence and recovery, I'm living a life really beyond my wildest dreams. But I've learned the hard way, and I'll talk a lot about this in my this morning, that complacency in the program is the greatest danger to my abstinence and ongoing recovery. There are things I need to hear myself say, lest I forget where compulsive overeating took me and how I've been, and I need to be reminded of how I've been restored to sanity around food and how that happened. First, I want to sort of give a little preface. I personally believe that the Big Book is divinely inspired. It has given a hopeless addict like me concrete instructions on how to find a power greater than myself that has restored me to sanity. But the one thing it doesn't do is give me a particular conception of that higher power. I'm to define that for myself. Like a lot of people, I use the word God to describe my higher power, but that's just my conception. My journey in OA has deepened my appreciation for the childhood of the religion of my childhood and early adulthood. But I know that's not the case for a lot of people. So I sincerely apologize in advance if my calling my higher power God makes any listeners, especially newcomers, uncomfortable. It's not my intention. What I want you to know is that I firmly believe that the writers of this book, the Big Book, left that question open for a reason. This solution found in the Big Book should be available to all hopeless alcoholics. And I believe it meets people where they are. So that said, I am asking God in this moment to help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, my brokenness, and you, God, for an open mind and a new experience of myself, my brokenness, and especially you. God, help me toss aside the need to be clever and speak the truth. So I've been coming to OA meetings since I was 27 years old. That's four decades, which is amazing to me. And the fact is, it's been far from a straight line of continuous abstinence. Like a lot of my fellows in OA, I've had long periods of abstinence, and along the way, I've relapsed back into compulsive overeating. I've gained and lost hundreds of pounds, but because of the steps of OA, I have, especially in the places where I'm going to highlight today, it's been a steadily expanding spiritual understanding through my life of God. The relapses and the bottoms I've experienced, I wouldn't wish on anyone. The isolation, the loneliness, the job losses, the broken relationships, I wouldn't wish that on anyone. But I no longer feel shame about those periods of relapses. I really don't. I used to see it as a checkered history in OA, but I don't see it that way anymore. The shame is really gone. What I see today at 68, now 68, is a steady sort of upward trajectory of my spiritual life that continues one day at a time. And this has brought me wonderful emotional and spiritual growth, plus joy beyond my imaginings, and God willing, this will continue until I take my last breath. If what I say today helps even one person avoid some of the pitfalls I've experienced, I will be grateful. As Larry said, the title of my talk is Turning Points, A Walk to the Big Book. I should say that turning is an important concept in my spiritual life. My sponsor and I talk a lot about turning my will over to the care of God, which is what it says in the steps, turn my will over to the care of God. We talk about the return. My sponsor and I talk about turning and realigning toward God. That has been what my journey has been about. Fits and starts, long-term abstinence, and then relapse, and returning, and turning again. There are places in the big book where, you know, you have that aha moment. Combined with that aha moment, combined with great teachers in the steps, has taught me to turn back to the right path. I'd like to share a few of the many sort of aha moments where I had that aha moment. But first, it probably would help for me to provide a few statistics, maybe some qualifying information for the newcomer, and a brief outline of my life in recovery, just to provide some context for some of the stories I'll be sharing. And my apologies to those of you that have heard my story, perhaps ad nauseum. My top weight, which was around the age of 38 to 40, was 265 pounds. Today, I'm maintaining a weight of around 140 pounds. Medically speaking, I would say that I have a binge eating disorder. In relapse, I can easily, over the course of a month or two, gain 60 to 75 pounds. But I can't be exact about that because I don't want to talk to people in OA. I don't want to get on a scale. I don't want to look at myself in the mirror. When I'm in the grip of the impulses around my trigger foods and ingredients, I don't want anyone to tell me to stop. In fact, the fact is, I can't stop. And I found that the relapses never get better. They only get worse. My most recent relapse was in the spring of 2023, and it only lasted a few months. I was eating my binge foods to the point of painful nausea. I was basically living to eat. I'd need to take like 2 to 4 hour breaks in binging to allow the nausea to subside so that I could eat again. But there was no comfort during those 2 to 4 hours because the whole time I'm obsessing about what I'm going to eat next. I'm so uncomfortable in my body and my mind, I feel like I'm going to jump out of my skin. an aside, for years in recovery, I thought to myself, I'll never become a bulimic. But during this most recent relapse, I tried bulimia and through the use of laxatives. And let me tell you, that's a special form of very painful hell. Like it says in the big book, I am in the grip of a progressive illness. It never gets better. When I crossed the line into compulsive overeating of the hopeless variety, this pickle will never turn back into a cucumber. I'll talk about, there's a place in the big book that was a turning point when I realized that, and I'll talk about that later. I need to remember, when I'm in relapse, my life goes from an expansive, joyful, challenging life in Technicolor to a life diminished to the size of a pinhead. Gray, it's depressing, I'm full of fear, where I'm being led around from one binge to the next. My productivity at work suffers. I've lost jobs due to the consequences of my compulsive overeating. I avoid relationships with men. I ate compulsively all through my fertile years. I stay in marginal or bad relationships with men for a long time. Or I continue in toxic relationships with female friends for too long. Or I stay in toxic jobs for too long. During my last relapse, I remember waking up in the middle of the night wanting desperately to go to the fridge. But I was physically unable because of the nausea. And I was thinking in my head, was racing about how horrible the next day was going to be because of the food hanger I knew I was would experience along with the lack of sleep. That's when, after so many relapses, thoughts like, I must be one of those people who are, quote, constitutionally incapable of grasping a manner of living that demands rigorous honesty. Is there something wrong with my constitution in those moments, I was wondering? So yes, I qualify to be here. But today, as a result of working the steps, entirely abstinent, and I'll talk about that, one day at a time, I actually have that expansive, joy-filled life, not without its challenges, but today I truly have a way of life that works in rough going. Being thin is really the least of my joys in my life today. So let me give you a Reader's Digest version of my story, when I found OA, and then pick up the big book, and I'll read a few passages of the big book that represented, for me, real turning points in my recovery. Just a few of them, not all of them. I entered OA on the advice of a first psychiatrist of mine. I found my way into her office when I was 27. I had just broken up with my first serious romantic relationship with a man. And I told this doctor of my problems with overeating, body image, and drinking, and she pointed me to OA. She said, "It's the best free therapy you'll ever find, and you'll learn the limits of control." Both those statements went completely over my head. It wasn't until years later that I really understood why she pointed me to. I would do whatever she said, so I did that. And along with therapy with this caring doctor, for the next 2 to 3 years, I attended OA, and I was hearing my story over and over again. At that time, however, I was using OA in the a la carte method. Those of us in the program who were in the program in the 80s and 90s will remember the meeting format suggested, quote, take what you want and leave the rest, and that's just what I did. I never got a sponsor. I can't remember anyone talking about working the steps, or if they did, I certainly wasn't taking it seriously or really listening. I thought to myself, I just have a little weight problem like my mother and my grandmother. Years later in recovery, when I was in recovery, my mother told me that my grandmother once shared a little secret with her about how she was controlling her weight, which she struggled with all of her life. She said, "I eat all weekend, everything that I want to eat, and then on Sundays, I throw up, and then I begin my diet on Monday." And my eyes widened, I'm sure, when my mother told me that story, and I said to her, "Well, Mom, do you know what that is?" And she didn't know, and I said, "That's bulimia." So I come to this by hereditary and honestly. In that first 10 years in OA, while I was doing great work in therapy with that kind doctor, my career was advancing, I was still drinking and heavily and overeating. I put down the alcohol completely in 1994, but within a few months of that, I reached that top weight of 265. Then in 1998, I started dating again. I was dumped after a second date with a man and took it really badly. I stumbled, thoroughly depressed and gaining weight yet again, into an OA meeting that was new to me, where I saw people who were thin and living in the solution. They were talking about being abstinent, working the steps, living a happy and useful life, and I was desperate. I got a sponsor that very night and started calling my food plan into her every day, and I committed to a weighted and measured food plan, no flour, no sugar, and nothing in between. I was desperate and would do whatever she told me to do. Well, in 8 months, I lost 90 pounds. I had never lost weight like that. That sponsor, who, by the way, remains one of my closest friends to this day, also did me one of the greatest favor anyone has ever done for me, before that caring doctor who pointed me to OA. She suggested I start doing 12-step studies because she said, "I don't know anyone with long-term abstinence who doesn't work the steps." So for the next 4 years, I did the steps in a group setting, all the steps in sequence, four times over 4 years. And man, I had a spiritual awakening. I've always been a religious person. My father used to call me the spiritual director in our family. I was to do grace at the meal, at, you know, major meals. But now, this time, as a result of working the steps abstinently, I was walking daily with God, and my food was neutral. I enjoyed it, and I was keeping the weight off. And I remember feeling and having the thought that nothing was as important as my relationship with God. By age 45, I was living a happy life, free from compulsive overeating, but I really wanted a family of my own. I was about 5 to 6 years abstinent due to my fear of intimate relationships and my body dysmorphia. I really had dated very little in my 20s and 30s. So as I said, I sort of ate through my fertile years. I hadn't met the man of my dreams, and I had no idea when I would, but because of recovery, I felt strong enough to pursue my heart's desire to become a parent. So I adopted my daughter. She was a baby at 9 months old from the former Soviet Republic of Kazakhstan. Back with my new baby at home and still maintaining that weight loss, my sponsor at the time gave me permission to delay getting back into the steps. She said, you know, you're getting your feet under you, trying to figure out how to raise a child on your own while maintaining a full-time demanding job. Just go to meetings. At the same time, this was the early 2000s, most people in OA were now emphasizing the need to do step work. But of course, I was too busy. I'm thin now. Why do I need to do the steps? I recall during those years being restless, irritable, and discontented a lot of the time, but I also had this joy of this new child in my life, which totally changed the balance and of my life, and I put the steps in third place. By the time Emily was three, that's my daughter, I had my first relapse, and for the next 10 years, I went in and out of relapse. I'd get a year, 6 months, but then I'd go back. As I said, each relapse got worse than the last, and the compulsive overeating and weight gain compromised my work, my parenting, and my relationships, and ultimately my health. The good news, in 2015, after a horrifying relapse, someone suggested I go to these fairly new meetings, which was part of the Vision for You Fellowship. My first vision sponsor took me through the steps quickly, and for the first time, I read the first 164 pages, line by line, first time in my recovery. That sponsor held a light on the path for me, and I had a spiritual awakening, very similar to the one I'd had in the 90s before I brought my daughter home. I suddenly realized what was missing. I wasn't working the steps. That's why I was relapsing. From roughly Emily's third to her 10th year home, I was relapsing over and over again in OA and couldn't figure out why. I could get abstinent, lose the weight I'd gain if I found a new sponsor, went back on the food plan, called in the food every day, and worked the tools. All these things helped me in the beginning, but I couldn't stay abstinent. It was a mystery to me why. During those 10 years of having Emily home for the first time, that I couldn't get abstinent. I also at times felt a deep, very deep longing for the spiritual connection I'd had before. When I came out of that fog with the help of the sponsor I mentioned in Vision, I was astonished by that first spiritual awakening. I was astonished by my capacity for denial and self-delusion. Emily's first 10 years home, all the while going to three meetings, sponsoring people, God forgive me, and saying, like a lot of people were saying at the podiums in OA and church basements at that time, abstinence is the single most important thing in my life today. I was still headed for a relapse because I wasn't working the steps. So over these past 10 or 11 years since I started in Vision, I've continued attending Vision meetings. And focusing my recovery on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Other than three short-lived but horrifying relapses, I've been abstinent and working the steps. So that brings me to my first turning point. In the doctor's opinion, in the forward to the first edition, page XIII, it states, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. In the 90s and 2000s in OA, I used to introduce myself as Elizabeth, the recovering compulsive overeater, or Elizabeth, the recovering food addict. At my first Vision for You meeting in 2015, I heard people introduce themselves as recovered. I thought, people can recover from this? I was desperate to get out of a relapse cycle I was in. And at that moment, hearing fellows describe themselves as recovered filled me with a tremendous sense of hope. It was one of those aha moments. What I learned in vision over the next year or so was that I have a twofold illness that is physical, for sure, but the larger aspect of my disease is centered in my mind. The physical part is this. If I get into any of my alcoholic foods, ingredients, or behaviors, I trigger that physical allergy, which causes me to lose the power of choice. I cannot stop eating those things. The larger aspect of my disease, on the other hand, is the mental obsession. That lives in my mind. It tells me that, quote, I'm not that bad, certainly not as bad as you people. I'm the exception. Yes, I am recovered today, but I am not ever going to be cured of this disease unless I'm addressing both aspects of my illness by working the steps while being entirely abstinent. Real recovery will elude me, and I'm on my way to another relapse that will be worse than all the ones that preceded it. Trust me on this. I know what I'm talking about, for me anyway. Another turning point for me from the big book also comes from the early part of the big book, The Doctor's Opinion. A sponsor had me identify three places in the doctor's opinion where the point is made that the addictive substance has to be down before the steps can be worked effectively. I've actually found five of those places, but I'm going to read two this morning. So in the doctor's opinion, on the third page, which is page XXVII, quote, of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit, unquote. And then at the bottom of XXX, on the sixth page of the doctor's opinion, quote, all these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot, all these meaning all these people, have one symptom in common. The hopeless compulsive overeater cannot, or drinker cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. And here's the kicker. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence, unquote. My experience is that abstinence comes first. Then my brain clears and I can work the steps to their maximum benefit. The truth of that has changed over time and deepened as I've experienced relapse and coming out of relapse. I must eliminate any and all new trigger foods that I'd allowed to enter my plan, and I also need to take out any foods that I'd previously identified as triggers that might have crept back in. This has been the only way for me. The food chatter has to be quieted for me if I'm going to have a new experience with the steps that will restore me to sanity around food. The food chatter keeps my mind and my heart shut off from what God needs me to know. So here's another passage from the doctor's opinion, a real turning point in my understanding about how I use food, even seemingly abstinent food, as my solution to soothe the stresses I experience in life when I'm trying to run the show myself. In the doctor's opinion on page XXVIII, which is the fourth page, quote, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks they see others taking with impunity, unquote. At one point, I was eating frozen bananas as my food at almost every meal. I would go from store to store to find the bananas that were of the perfect optimal ripeness so that when frozen, they'd be super sweet. If I'd had a bad day, I recall at the time thinking, well, this is a horrible day at work, but at least I have those weighed and measured frozen bananas to look forward to. Reluctantly, which should have told me something, I told my sponsor that I thought I needed to give up the frozen bananas, that they might be triggering my illness. She could hear the self-pity in my voice as I was telling her this, and her response was calm and clear. She said, "You know what, Elizabeth? When I identify something that I can feel, where I can feel I'm chasing the effect that it will give me, I actually look forward to giving it up because I know it's going to bring me closer to God." I've had to give up eating all frozen fruit. My body doesn't know the difference between frozen fruit and ice cream. Both of those things trigger the physical allergy in my body and create the chatter that I'm talking about that keeps me blocked from God, the God of my understanding. I think someone may be unmuted because I'm hearing a lot of wind in the background. So if you're walking and listening, if you could hit star one, that would be great. I'm still hearing that chatter, not chatter. I'm still hearing the wind. So if someone could just star one. Okay, great. For those of you who listened to the 7 or 8 o'clock Vision for You meeting last week, you'll know that we just started reading Chapter 3, More About Alcoholism, in the big book. And we read and commented on the first two paragraphs. Those two paragraphs just are so important to me. They're two of my favorites in the big book, and they've represented really wonderful turning points for me as I've in my journey. So on page 30, it says, "Most of us have been willing to admit we were real." Excuse me, let me start over. "Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently may be, has to be smashed." Unquote. Even today, having 3 years of back-to-back abstinence under my belt, I can forget the reality of what I just read. And on this topic, I highly recommend a special edition that you'll find in the Vision for You archives. It's entitled, quote, "Recovery from Relapse, Ending Our Countless Vain Attempts," unquote. It's a wonderful talk by one of our fellows that was recorded on December 6th, 2015. And I believe this speaker updated the talk in 2024. The fact is, the big reason why I kept relapsing, and I understand this today, was because I was unwilling to admit deep in my heart that I am a real compulsive overeater. One of my step guides asked me when I was coming out of relapse and starting the steps again, she asked, "So what's going to be different this time, Elizabeth? It sounds like you still believe that you can think your way out of this problem." She went on to share a quote with me, and that is, "The seat of all motivation is in the heart." She went on to say, "Elizabeth, you need to read the big book with your heart." I agree with the writers of the big book. No one's ego likes to admit that they are different from others. Certainly I didn't, because I'm human, and as a human, I have an ego. this is funny. A former sponsor of mine used to say, "OA is not a weight reduction program. This is an ego reduction program." And I believe that. If I'm working the steps of the big book, my ego reduces. I've relapsed over and over because my ego has an uncanny ability to regenerate itself. If I am not connecting with God humbly on a daily basis and working the steps in abstinence, my ego will take over the show. The disease that lives in my mind, that speaks to me in the familiar voice, the familiar sound of my own voice, will start telling me lies about my own power, and I'll start believing those lies. The only way that I am going to be immune from the lie that I can eat XYZ food or practice XYZ behaviors in safety, to be immune from those things, I have to stay close to this fellowship. I have to talk to my fellows regularly, stay accountable to my sponsor, and sponsor others. Humility and honesty, rigorous honesty, are the keys for me. I've talked about that 10-plus years when I was using OA as a diet group support. When it came to my recovery program, I was basically a practicing agnostic. My food program, my program was black and white. You're either abstinent or you weren't. One messy meal in a restaurant would send me into a shame spiral. Can I still call myself abstinent when I speak at meetings? Do I have to go back to day one? Today, as a result of the turning points I experienced in my latest step study, I am embracing emotional sobriety one day at a time. And I'll talk more about that a little bit later. If I have a messy meal in a restaurant, that's the first thing I need to talk to my sponsor about the very next morning. She holds space for me to talk about the motives behind the choices I might have made at that meal. She pressure tests me for rationalizations. Then, together, we unpack what might really be going on, a situation or relationship that requires a 10-step, or a need to redouble my commitment to quiet time in the morning. Getting back on the beam spiritually is the key. Another turning point for me in this chapter, which I love, which is more about alcoholism, is where the writers give us two examples of drinkers who picked up after periods of sobriety. There's, of course, Jim, the car salesman, who's been demoted. That's on page 35 to 37. And then the other, who's an accountant, Fred, on page 39 to 43. Fred picked up alcohol after a very successful business trip. On the one hand, Jim, the car salesman, was depressed. Fred, on the other hand, was on top of the world. A turning point for me was when I really analyzed the difference between those two experiences and applied it to my own history of relapse. I can relapse when my life is spiritually dry or exceptionally stressful, like when my parents died within 9 months of each other, or when I was diagnosed and treated for breast cancer. On the other hand, I can fall into a state of complacency when everything's coming up roses, when my daughter is thriving, when my job is going great, when I meet the man of my dreams at age 60 and get married. Yes, that actually happened to me, much to my surprise. At the bottom of page 14 of Bill's story, it says, quote, if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he would not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. The fact is, enlarging my spiritual life takes daily work. And I'll be honest, a lot of the time with my busy life, I can think to myself, I don't have time for a 10-step or to do my quiet time or get another sponsee. But I can't stay in that complacency for more than a day or two. Seriously. I do the service like I'm doing today on this line, so I will remember Jim and Fred. I may not want to do service, but I turn my will over anyway. There's that word turn again. This is a program of action for me. When I do these things, when I turn my will honestly and take the action toward God again, the results are always the same. I get conscious contact with God. I return to that expansive, joy-filled, not without challenges, useful life. I simply cannot afford to become complacent. At age 68 and, you know, with a 70-year-old husband, trials are certainly ahead for us. Medical. We've already started to lose lifelong friends. So I just cannot afford to be complacent. So I want to move on to another turning point in the steps. And it's about what I call the M-dash. So when I got abstinent on April 10th, 2023, my most recent abstinence, the one I'm in now, I asked an OA friend I'd known for about 15 years to be my sponsor. I knew she had at least 4 years of solid abstinence, and I'd heard her speak on the vision meetings about her spiritual recovery. Something deep inside, God, I believe, pointed me in her direction and suggested that I ask her to be my sponsor. I surrendered to the process again. I cleaned up my food plan, and she immediately suggested a new step study, like the other great sponsor I had. This one was long and drilled very deep. In that step study, I learned the power of the M-dash. Step one reads, quote, "We are powerless over food. Our lives have become unmanageable," unquote. An M-dash is another word for a kind of long hyphen. I Googled M-dash yesterday and it says, quote, "The M-dash is a versatile, punctuation mark, roughly the width of an M, long used to indicate a long pause, break in thought, or added emphasis within a sentence. It often replaces commas." My step guide at the time pointed out what they believe the writers of the Big Book were getting at. And now I believe the admission of powerless over my addictive substance or process is just a beginning. Abstinence is an essential starting point. Unless I am embracing this way of living every day, OA becomes merely a diet. And this way of life can be adopted by non-addicts, too. And the Big Book writers knew this when they wrote in the foreword of the first edition, quote, "And besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all," unquote. What comes after the M-dash points toward something my sponsor encouraged me to embrace as a larger goal, beyond abstinence, beyond a healthy body weight, beyond adherence to disciplines. She was pointing towards something called emotional sobriety as a way to stay on a spiritual path. Earlier in OA, when I used to pray upon awakening, I would take the first three steps on my knees and I would say the following prayer: "God, I am powerless over my trigger foods and other substances and behaviors. And when I use any of these things as a drug, my life becomes unmanageable." That's not what the Big Book says. Today, my prayer is quite different. This is how I take the first three steps in the morning. "God, I am powerless over my trigger foods, ingredients, and behaviors. I'm powerless over alcohol, sex, spending, and most importantly, I'm powerless over what anyone else in the world thinks, feels, or does. My life is unmanageable by me alone. But I've come to believe that a power greater than myself, you, God, can restore me to sanity around my food and can return me to humility, proportion, right thinking around the unmanageability of my life. And so I'm making a decision, God, in this moment to turn my will and my life over to your care." Then I say the third step prayer. Then I follow that with the seventh step prayer. And then I say or read, depending, page 87 in the Big Book on awakening. And then I start my day. Another place in the Big Book that is important and has always been really a tremendously important paragraph to me. One step sponsor asked me to read the paragraph at the bottom of page 25 in chapter 2, "There is a Solution." Quote, "If you are as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle of the road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible, and if we had passed into the region where from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, and the other, to accept spiritual help." I had read this paragraph before. I never really understood it. It was confusing to me. That sponsor asked me a point-blank question, which helped me unpack this paragraph. She said, "Elizabeth, what's your intolerable situation?" That put me at a loss. I answered, well, I guess being in the food, compulsively overeating. Her reply was this: that's not my intolerable situation. Do you want to know what mine is? And of course I did. And she said, my intolerable situation is being abstinent without a higher power. Wow, that was an aha moment for sure. In an instant, I understood that I had been living in the intolerable situation for 10 years, all while going to meetings, being abstinent, being in a normal-sized body. But I was relapsing. All those years, I was using human aid, my own aid, to stay on a food plan. But I wasn't working the steps and enlarging my spiritual life. So I want to offer some closing thoughts. I've heard it said that steps one to three are about my relationship with God. Steps 4 to 9 are about my relationship with myself. And steps 10 to 12 are about my relationship with the world. The inventory process in steps 4 through 9 have been indispensable to me through the years. They've helped me grow spiritually and in turn improved all my relationships with my family, friends, work colleagues. By working steps 10, 11, and 12, I'm able to stay on a spiritual path of recovery. And God willing, I never have to compulsively overeat again, one day at a time. I'll never be finished learning and growing, God willing. I've done many four-step inventories. I've given those inventories away in numerous fifth steps. I felt the peace and serenity that comes from that and made amends to the people I've harmed through steps 8 and 9. I could spend a whole special edition just on the incredible ways this house cleaning process has helped bring me closer to God and giving me that joyful, expansive, not without challenges life. Finding a way and working the steps in a variety of ways have deepened my understanding how most of my problems and challenges have their roots in my selfishness, my self-centeredness, dishonesty, and fear, especially fear. The writers call these character defects. I like to think of them as my growing edges. Takes the edge off a little bit for me. I could also share an entire special edition on steps 6 and 7, which in 2 short paragraphs ask me to be ready to have God remove my growing edges. Some I may learn to retain. Growing edges I may want to retain because for whatever reason they're fun or they're habits, or because I fear I won't be myself if I give them away. Someone once said to me, letting go is not loss. It is space for what is true. And that's God for me today. Truth, or if you will, the great reality. Those three words, the great reality, appear in the big book more than one place and are very significant to me. I believe God gave me free will for a reason. The big book points to this in a variety of places. I read that aligning my will to God's is the proper use of the will. So I am using my will to align with God. When I read those words, I'm supposed to have a will. I used to talk about, quote, taking my will back, and that's why I relapsed. I'll be honest, now I'm not really wild about that phrase anymore. I'm not even wild about the word surrender. I believe the choice to turn, there's that word again, turn. The choice to turn my will toward God is mine to make. I have that choice every day. I have the choice to put my will in alignment with God's will for me as best I can know his will. My sponsor and I talk a lot about how we are co-creating our lives with God. God is the power. I am just his agent. God is my director. I am a player, but I am a player, and I turn my will in the direction of God as best I could, can, not perfectly, one day at a time. So I really, you know, I feel like I've been talking a long time. It's 9:20. But I would like to tell the story about meeting my husband. It happened when I was 60 years old. My daughter was 14 years old at the time. She was a typical teenager. She really didn't want to see much of me and wasn't really listening to what I was saying. And I was getting a lot of eye rolling and, you know, she didn't want to go on hikes with me anymore. I really wanted to go hiking with someone. So I went online again. I hadn't dated in years. I was too busy and happily bringing up my daughter. But I felt like I had the bandwidth to go back online and maybe try to meet someone I could go hiking with. The first guy I met was Alex. And we started a relationship. We started to date. And very early in that relationship, I remember two things distinctly. First, I remember thinking, this guy's really funny. He's incredibly smart, much better read than I am. But you know what? I'm not going to try to be clever here. If he sends me a clever text, I'm going to respond as my authentic self. I'm not going to try to image manage. I'm not going to try to be somebody that I'm not. I'm just going to be myself because you know what? Whatever. Whether I meet the man of my dreams is really in God's hands. So, you know, as I'm doing this new dating thing, I'm just not going to filter myself. So I didn't filter myself. Turns out he was the man of my dreams. And the other thing is that's interesting about this is that he's an atheist. I never thought I would meet an atheist and fall in love because, you know, I'm a religious person. I'm a very spiritual person. You know, because of the time I spend with God, the deep part of myself that has God and that bubbles up and shares truth with me, the truth that God gave me in that moment was, it doesn't matter what Alex believes. What matters is what you believe, Elizabeth, and how you live your life authentically, truly. And with full awareness of who you are. And so our love, my love with Alex just flourished and grew. And, you know, it's not been without challenges, but it's been joyful. And I did have a couple of relapses while I've been, you know, was with in a relationship with Alex. And, you know, those are for another special edition, but and I've already spoken about my understanding of why those things happened. But today I have, I'm living with a wonderful man, and it is because I am my authentic self. And I found that authentic self in my relationship with my higher power, God. And I have found it through these years. God is my director. I am a player. God is my power. I am his agent. I turn my will every day over to the care of my God, and I'm living a wonderful life. So I'll leave it there and say thank you for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth, for a very authentic, just very straightforward presentation. We're so appreciative. Real gem for the archive, so thank you for that. And a couple of things before we transition to our Q&A. First thing is, let me give you the share ID number for Elizabeth D's presentation this morning. That number is 23,357. That's 23357. And then please stick around with us till the end of the recorded portion of the presentation so that we can ask Elizabeth for her contact information. So stick around for that. So now let's transition over to Q&A. If you have a question for Elizabeth D., press star one and give me your first name. Who has a question?
From New Jersey.
Who is from New Jersey?
Vasi.
Vasi? With a V?
Yep. B as in boy.
Vasi? Oh, Vasi.
Joy MB, California.
Joy MB.
Well, Rita R., Massachusetts.
Gotcha, Rita.
Mara Z.
Hey, Mara. That would be Sherry, if you hear her barking. I think Sherry, my dog, has a question. You might not hear her. I got Vasi, Joy, Rita, and Mara. Anybody else? Okay, let's start with that. And if I got it right, did I? Vasi, followed by Joy. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for your service, and thank you, Elizabeth. What an incredible presentation. So I'm in program for almost 16 years, mostly abstinent, and I am struggling with relapse now after 3 years of back-to-back abstinence. So this talk is just very timely. My question is, how do you enlarge your spiritual life on a daily basis? Thank you.
Thank you, Vasi. That's a great question. How do I enlarge my spiritual life? What comes off the top of my head is, first of all, I live my life fully. And second, I live that full life in reference, constantly referencing the big book, and practicing certain regular spiritual practices. And what I find is that as I live my life, and as life happens, which it does, it can get lifey sometimes, wonderful things happen, horrible losses, I'm starting to lose some of my oldest and dearest friends. As life happens, if I am staying close to those spiritual disciplines every day, quiet time in the morning, saying my prayers, meditating, just sitting quietly and reading various spiritual literature and opening my mind and my heart to God, and also very importantly, keeping in touch with my sponsor and allowing her to hold space for me to process what's happening in my life in reference to what God may be asking me to turn toward in terms of behaviors that I need to follow, or things that I need to remember to do to be of service. And I just find that the enlargement of my spiritual understanding just happens as a result of living my life and practicing these spiritual tools. I belong to a church. I have a religious tradition, which has definitely complemented. It says in the big book, make use of what other religious traditions offer. The big book is very open to instructing me to find God in other religions, and not just my own religion. I also enlarge my spiritual life by learning about other religions. I believe God is the great reality that we cannot ever fully understand with our temporal minds or express in words. I believe God is beyond all that and yet present in each one of us as a reality. I have that in me, and if I am doing the things and turning my will and doing the practices and taking the action toward the spiritual tools, then my life, my spiritual life enlarges. It starts with abstinence. I cannot have the food chattering in my brain, so I need to be entirely abstinent. Once that's in place, the enlarging of the spiritual life is certainly critically important. So thank you for that question. It's a really nice, really good one.
All right. Next up, we have Joy, followed by Rita. Good morning, Joy. Joy, press star one.
Thank you so much this morning for the host. Thank you so much, Elizabeth. Your statements and your story are inspiring and jaw-dropping and a matching of mine. I went to 100,000 OA meetings, and not until age 80 did somebody say, there's the blue book over there. You need to do the steps. So what I want to know, my question is, how do you go through the steps repeatedly? In what way? I know you use them every day, but then secondly, have you ever used the OA official workbook, or is there one?
I have, Joy. When I had my first spiritual awakening in Overeaters Anonymous, that was before I adopted my daughter. It was when I talked about the 6 years or so where I had back-to-back abstinence, working with a sponsor who at the time said to me, you'll recall when she said, I don't know anyone who has long-term abstinence who doesn't work the steps of OA. So I took her seriously and I did what she said. And as I said, I did one step study after another. Each step study took about a year. And after 4 years, and you know, during that time, I became, you know, my spiritual was an awakening for me. It was an experience, so it was gradual. And I noticed that I was changing, that I wasn't reacting so much. I was less selfish. I was And you know, sort of my intuition, that working part of, you know, the working part of the mind that was turning me toward right action and so forth. And during that time, we weren't using the big book very much. We were using a variety of different literature, like the OA 12 and 12. We were using OA's material as well. And all of it was helpful to me. And the big book was sort of something that we turned to occasionally when we needed illustration. But here's what happened to me. It's not that those books aren't helpful. What happened to me is that my disease progressed over time. I believe it progresses even when I'm abstinent. My recovery is progressive, but capacity for relapse gets worse. So by the time I had, you know, and there was another period where I started to go to another kind of meeting, which is for all addictions, people would go and study the big book and read it line by line and then share. But those asked for a very long period of doing a four-step, and I just couldn't stay abstinent long enough to get through a long four-step. When I got to Vision for You in 2015, I heard the word recovered. The other thing I heard was, we go through the steps with our sponsor very quickly. And I'm like, sign me up for that. But they were focused entirely on the big book. And that was when I discovered the original source of this material, which I think, at least for me, is where I need to stay. The big book for me is the source material. It is the ultimate instruction manual. It is not a self-help book. It is meant to show me precisely how to recover through the experience of others. So that is what I use most of the time now. Actually, I'd say 99% of the time. During my most recent sort of walk through the steps, which was in 2023, I was pointed toward the AA 12 and 12, and I do use that. I really like the AA 12 and 12, but really for me, it's about the original source material. For this instruction manual, it's all about the big book for me, at least when it comes to 12-step literature. I do read other literature, but when it comes to working the steps, it's my go-to.
Okay, thanks for the question, Joy. Yeah. Okay, next up we have Rita, followed by Maura. Rita, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thank you, Larry, for your service. And Elizabeth, that was really a wonderful, wonderful share. Thank you for your experience, strength, and hope. My question, it might be a little, I don't know, possible to kind of decipher out, but I'm wondering if there are any particular steps that really do help more in terms of getting to your authentic self, or is there a step study that you've been through that has really helped you with the dishonesty piece and really drilling down with that? Thank you.
Thanks very much for the question. That is, it's a very clear question, and I appreciate it. I'm not prepared to talk about any particular step study that has been helpful, but I really don't want to talk about that because for a lot of reasons. What I really want to talk about is what were the steps. Such a good question that pointed me toward my authentic self. I can't think of any one step. I believe it's been my experience that the steps need to be worked, at least for me, consecutively, one after the other, because they very much, for me, build from one to the next. First, I admit I'm powerless, that my life is unmanageable by me. I'm powerless over my trigger foods, ingredients, and behaviors. And then because of that, I put down the food, and I have to put down the food, and sometimes it's not easy. It's hard, and there's a detox period. So that's where step two comes in, and I get the hope around, okay, there is a power that's coming that's going to restore me to sanity. Hang on. So I hang on, and then step three comes in, where I'm asked to take an action, which is to turn my will and my life over to the care of my higher power. Then I go into a rigorous house cleaning, and I deal with those things, the buildup of human emotion that over the course of my relapse have built up. And what's essential for me is that I have a guide, an experienced guide who can take me through, and that I am accountable to that guide first and foremost for my food, and that the food is down and it's not chattering my brain. And secondly, it is holding space for me as I study and apply what I'm learning in the steps to my life on a daily basis. That's ultimately what the step study is. And, you know, just as I get to the fourth step, I start to get scared. Oh, how can I, you know, write down these character defects or these growing edges? They're so painful. I can't look at them because, oh, I'm going to have to talk about this. I'm going to have to do a ninth step. Then I have a sponsor, and that sponsor reminds me, you're not in the ninth step. Remember that. You're in the fourth step. Don't think about that right now. Stay where you are. So it's the process of doing this with someone who's experienced, who's also walking the path before I did, and is perhaps has a little more spiritual recovery than I have, and is working toward and is emotionally sober. That has been the key to me to finding my authentic self, that unfiltered self that I try to embrace on a daily basis. Not perfectly, but thanks for the question, Rita. Hope that helps.
All right, next up we have Maura, and then we'll see if where we are on time. Maura, good morning.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks so much for your service. Elizabeth, thank you for a unique perspective. I really appreciate your share this morning and your experience, strength, and hope. You talk about talking with your sponsor. So my question is, what do you work on with your sponsor, and how often are you speaking with him or her?
First of all, Maura, there's nothing unique about me. I had a sponsor say to me once, you know, I was talking about, you know, my problems with food and I was sort of complaining. I was kind of in this self-pity place around my, I'm a compulsive overeater, poor me. And she said, Elizabeth, you are a garden variety compulsive overeater. You're not special. I really liked that. And I never forgot it. There's nothing unique about me. And but I appreciate you that you like that. Maybe I brought something new to the phone here, and that's good. But anyway, I just need to remind myself of that. So how do I work with my sponsor? Now I'm abstinent for I'm starting my fourth year, and I'm committed to talking to that sponsor 5 days a week. Sometimes we can't. She lives a busy life. I live a busy life. Sometimes we can't talk in the morning. Usually it's like just a 15-minute call. I commit my food daily to her. That just has always worked for me and keeps me accountable. And, you know, like I talked about, if I have a messy meal, something's going on. And I know that I have her to talk to the next day. And that's just been very, very important to me. Previously in my OA journey, there was this sense of, okay, well, I'm done with the steps and I'm thin. I have arrived. There's that place in Bill's story where he says, you know, self-knowledge, you know, I've got the self-knowledge. Now I know about my disease. I had arrived, blah, blah, blah. You know, that's another form of complacency for me. And I cannot go there. The daily accountability and the sense that, you know, someone's going to lovingly hold space for me draws me into that relationship and allows me to be entirely honest. It's a great gift. She knows what a gift she is in my life. Believe me, I tell her all the time. But, you know, she tells me I'm a gift in her life too. What do I do? What can I say more? I want to say more about this because it's such a great question. There are times when I have to do 10 steps, and sometimes I do those 10 steps with the sponsor, and sometimes I do them with other fellows. She is not my only guide in this program. I have other people that are, quote, 10-step buddies that I go to. I have a community. She's not my higher power. I find my higher power many times. I find God in my daily work by connecting to quiet time, through my daily review, and also by bringing authentically what's going on with me and where I'm being selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and afraid. I bring that into conversation with other recovered compulsive overeaters. And that really helps me. The other thing I do is I do service. And doing service means, taking people through the steps, helping them identify what might be triggering their disease and keeping them in relapse. And if I'm doing that, then I'm constantly saying things like, I'm telling my story. And if I'm telling my story, I can't ask them to look at their food plan and what might be triggering them if I'm not asking myself that same question every day. So people, recovered people, people that are trying to get recovered, the bottom line is emotional sobriety for me is about that second half of the first step. My life is but unmanageable by me alone. I need to be turning myself toward God on a daily basis. And believe me, you know, I am not doing this perfectly. You know, I can go a couple of days and not do quiet time, and I can tell I'm starting to feel squirrely in my program, and the food starts to call. And, you know, I just know I have to go right back to my spiritual disciplines. I hope that helps.
Thanks, Maura. Okay, we have time perhaps for a couple more questions. If there are more, press star one. Give me your first name.
Chanel T.
Hi, Chanel.
Hana Yetta.
Let's stop with those two, and then we'll see if we get that far. So we got Chanel, Hana Yetta, and Marge. Chanel, your turn. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, as always, for your service, Larry. Oh, hi, I'm Chanel T. I'm grateful and recovered compulsive eater here in Washington State, all by the grace of God today. Elizabeth, thank you so much. Happy birthday. Two birthdays in one. How amazing for you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. I want to ask you just a hypothetical, okay, but possibly I'm experiencing this with a sponsee. If you have a sponsee who has been hanging out on one of her step nines, she's just not getting it done. And there's some trauma involved, and we're not going to get into details here. There's no need. She just won't do it. Any suggestions as a sponsor on where to go with that? She's doing everything else, but she won't do that. Thank you.
I cannot believe how timely that question is. And I think, Chanel, let me ask you this. Are you in the, have we talked before, are you possibly in my phone book, and are you on the Vision for You member list?
Yes, yes, and yes.
Okay. I think, you know, I haven't had a lot of experience with that. And I think that what I would prefer to do is have an offline conversation with you. So if that's okay with you, I'll give you a call later today.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Right. Yeah, thanks, Chanel. Okay, next up we have Hana Yetta, followed by Marge. Hana Yetta.
Hello. Excuse me. Good morning, everyone. Larry, thank you as always for your service. And Elizabeth, I haven't heard this in a long time, but you were like, oh, that was me. It was really a lot of my story. It was wonderful. And happy birthday. Happy double birthday.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so now, question. I spend an hour in prayer, a lot of religious prayers, but prayer and talking to God, doing the first three steps. When I have time, I say the 11th step upon awakening. But do you think that is the same as prayer and meditation? I kind of like mix it all together. And I was wondering your opinion. If I do mainly prayer, is that the same thing as, because to me, prayer is meditation. But I was wondering your opinion on that.
Well, for me, and it's different for everyone, but For me, prayer and meditation are two different things. For me, prayer means, and if you look it up in the dictionary, it's a petition to God. It's talking to God. And meditation, on the other hand, is about listening. There's a lot about meditation written everywhere, and there are lots of great apps. And I have one in particular that I like. I don't want to talk about outside things, so I'm not going to. Doesn't need to go there. But I have one in particular that I like, and I use. First, to quiet my body down and get to breathing. And breathing and getting quiet really helps me because, you know, we all have very active minds. Then I say the steps, and then I start my prayers. And my prayers, I told you a little bit about what they are, and usually... And sometimes in my relaxation, quiet time, in my meditation times, sometimes answers will come to some of my issues. They just bubble up. It feels a little bit like that working part of the mind where just things sort of drop into my head from seemingly out of nowhere. And that to me is kind of where I find my higher power. I see prayer as two distinct things, but they intermingle with one another and work together. I do a lot of writing too, especially if I need to do a 10th step. I will often write I'll write out that 10th step using the big book as a guide. And there are questions in the book about what we do at the end of the evening. I will ask myself, you know, how did I do today? And I'll ask the questions that are in that part of the book, 87 to 88. So these are all things that I do in my quiet time. I do not spend as much as an hour. I would love to be able to do that. Maybe in retirement, I will have that kind of time. Sometimes I'm just sitting my butt in the chair and it's all rote and I'm just saying the words and I don't feel it and my mind is racing. Sometimes that's the way it is for me in quiet time. And, you know, my sponsor and I talk about this and we lovingly give ourselves permission to be loved by God exactly the way we are. And you know, I forgive myself for those times. I can't look at this as cookie cutter, like a checkoff box, you know, like, oh, check that off, got that done. You know, and sometimes, you know, it can be like that. But if I try to do, and I don't do it perfectly, slow myself down and bring my life experiences to the care of God, through the prayers that I am saying and through the meditation that I'm doing and try to listen. And by the way, often the prayer is throughout the day. I am hearing God's voice in my head more and more as my emotional sobriety is enlarging. I find that voice, that intuition is more and more prevalent, and I am less apt to fly off the handle. Or, you know, sometimes with a vendor, I will still be impulsive and, you know, say something that I don't want to say, and then I make amends. But it's just that's sort of I think I'm kind of off the track here a little bit, but I hope that helps give you a sense of how I do it.
If you want something front and center, like to me, those two towers are the best. Those are probably five and up.
Someone
I thought you were five.
Someone needs to
There we go. Okay. Thanks. Next question, quickly. Yeah, we'll see. Marge, if we can get in the quick question, that would be great. Good morning, Marge.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you much for that. And Elizabeth D., I've had the good fortune to be a beneficiary of your kindness, your spirituality, and your generosity last November. I just have one question. You talked about your sponsor, talking to your sponsor about some food calling you. And I believe, I just want to see if I got it right. So she loves when the food calls her because when she doesn't answer the call, she feels closer to God. Did I get that right?
It's actually, there are actually two different sponsors. But it's an, okay. that's kind of a nice mashup though, Marge. The first sponsor said to me, it was around the issue of if I am noticing that there's a food that's singing and dancing on the plate for me and that I'm getting obsessed about, or like I can feel that, then I will go to my sponsor and say, I think maybe, can you help me with it? And then that sponsor said to me, oh, and I was in self-pity, like, am I going to only end up eating, like, drinking water? You know, if I keep giving food up, you know, is it going to be over for me? I'm going to just end up with just water. And that's when she said, you know, get out of your self-pity. She didn't say that, but that's what she basically said.
Yes.
Oh, Elizabeth, you know, when I confront those, I know it's because I'm being called to come closer to God. And that changed the whole thing. That was an aha moment for me. The other way, the other sponsor, on the other hand, she holds space for me if I have, usually it's when I have a messy meal at a restaurant. You know, restaurants, you have people there, and sometimes no family is there. And family can be, you know, my daughter and my husband are there, and it can be a little stressful, you know, because she's still getting used to me being married and not being her number one. Okay. So, you know, sometimes the meal can be a little messy or whatever. When I'm with my husband and my daughter at a restaurant, I bring my scale because it's going to be a messy conversation. But, you know, there are times when, and I'm at a business meeting with someone and I can't bring my scale because it will definitely be a distraction. In that case, you know, if I felt a little squirrely about it at the end of the meal, like, I think I may have, whatever, taken too much protein or whatever, I talk to my sponsor the next day and we talk about it. What's going on? And she, it's not black and white. It's not a question of going back to day one. Those days are over for me. I am embracing emotional sobriety in the steps, entirely abstinent. And so, anyway, thanks for the mashup. It was really cute.
Thank you.
It was good.
Thank you.
I like the mashup, Marge. Thank you. And thank you to everybody. Thank you, Elizabeth, for the presentation. And thank you to everyone who participated this morning. We certainly appreciate you. And so we are now, please hang out to the close of the meeting. We'll get Elizabeth's contact information. Once again, the share ID for this morning's presentation is 23,357. That's 23357. So now allow me to close from the, well, let me go to the big book. Why don't I do that? Page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past, give freely of what you find, and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy death.